If you walked into a swamp in the north central or northeastern regions of the United States, you would probably find a diverse community of trees and shrubs, along with a lot of mud. Amongst those trees, you might find black ash, a water-tolerant ash species that helps to maintain water levels in forest and wetland ecosystems. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you've probably heard about emerald ash borer, or EAB, an invasive beetle from Asia that has become one of the most destructive forest insect pests to ever invade North America, killing hundreds of millions of ash trees in just 30 years. If you were to walk into a swamp in Michigan or another area that has had an emerald ash borer invasion for a long time, you would likely not find any black ash trees. This is because black ash is the most vulnerable and preferred host species for EAB. In Michigan alone, the majority of the state's black ash trees have been killed by emerald ash borer, and it's expected that this trend will continue elsewhere as well. The loss of black ash imposes a great threat to the unique ecosystems in which they grow, but also threatens the traditions and practices surrounding the species that have been passed down through generations of basket makers amongst First Nations and Native American people. For millennia, these basket makers have been using black ash to craft baskets, and the tree has become an incredibly important aspect of the cultural identity for many indigenous groups throughout the species range. Today, I sit down with Les Benedict from the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe to talk about basket making, the impact of emerald ash borer, and the hope that still exists for preserving black ash and basketry traditions in the future. This is the Emerald Ash Borer Information Network podcast, and I'm your host, River Matthew. Would you mind introducing yourself and talking a bit about who you are and what you do?
My name's Les Benedict. I'm the assistant director for the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe's Environment Division, but also I'm the Black Ash Coordinator for the Akwesasne Task Force on the Environment. And through the Akwesasne Task Force on Environment, I've been, involved with Black Ash since it became an issue in our community. It goes back, to 1990. What do I do? I'm an environmental manager, but I'm also a community member who's deeply interested in responding to the community's needs with regard to black ash. In fact,
Les's work with black ash began in 1990 with a roundtable meeting in which community members discussed environmental issues facing Akwesasne. Tribal elders at the time raised the concern of a lack of black ash on the reservation, as well as black ash trees that didn't look very healthy and were dying. This really sparked Les's interest, and at the time, there was a lack of knowledge surrounding black ash ecology in the scientific community, leaving a lot of questions left to be answered. Questions like, how can we ensure that we have good trees for basketry in these forested wetlands? And is it possible for us to plant black ash trees in these wetland sites? Since then, Les has done extensive work on projects that have provided a wealth of information surrounding black ash ecology and management. These projects included collaboration with other tribes, federal agencies, and universities, strengthening connections and relationships across the board. He has quite literally watched black ash grow from seedlings and now sees his work coming full circle as black ash is facing emerald ash borer.
I always look back on the beginning of this project because one lady in particular who's has passed now, her name was Marita Skidder. She was from Cornwall Island. She was actually an agricultural liaison for the Mohawk Council of Akwesasne. But she became involved with black ash more. She was an elderly woman, but she was heavily involved. And her approach was we always have to try something. In the very beginning, we had a lot to learn. What we learned first off was that there's very little literature out there about black ash. There's no information of black ash management. I think maybe one or two, maybe three at the most, in terms of articles, and no books certainly on it. If anything, they were just part of maybe a field manual and some descriptions of black ash, but there was so much information that was lacking. But since that time, a lot more information has been generated through studies on black ash and ash in general. So it's been quite a trip from the very beginning. Like I said, it started off as a request and then a question and a request at the same time.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about sort of the cultural importance of Black Ash and why, you know, answering those questions that you were trying to answer and did answer in the late 90s and early 2000s, why is that so important to the community of Akwesasne and then other Indigenous communities as well?
Well, it definitely is a gold standard for basketry. I've kind of expanded my concept of a basketry to include containers. So, and I think the plight of EAB, of ash and light of EAB, has changed my concept of utilitarian or even ornamental basketry. And rather than just focus on woven baskets, it's expanded to containers. So containers is a broader concept or a broader topic, and basketry is a subset of that. And I learned that, for instance, containers are very important to our community. They're vessels that have been used for a number of purposes. And as we even explored looking at seed preservation, we learned that probably basswood and elm have been utilized for containers. We had caches of native corn that was stored in, I think, elm bark containers and stored in the ground as a, you know, as a reserve for our communities. So basketry being a subset of those, of the containers, is very important because of a number of reasons. Number one, it's been a source of cultural identity, source of pride for a community, but it's so integrated with the ability of the community to be resilient and to survive, because there's this entire industry that was based on basketry and the ability of our basket makers to provide a living based on land resources when there was actually very little other opportunities for community members to work or to have any sort of income or to support themselves. So the basketry, from that aspect, provided the means of a living and a means of living for families. Baskets were traded for either for credit or for money or for goods. And that's what allowed our community to survive. And I've since learned that that's also the same for many of the other communities, other native communities throughout New England. And it's also been a source of intertribal connection. So I've learned there are some of the tribes that did not make baskets, but the baskets were traded between tribes that didn't make baskets for other materials. Without, I guess in general, you think about our treaty belts and our, those are actually made from quahog shells. And if you look where we are, we don't have any quahog here. So, I mean, so there is definitely, that's an example of intertribal trade. And also, you think about where you are in Michigan, that's a source of copper. So you think about the trade routes that were established in the intertribal interactions that took place and trade. There's examples of copper amulets or copper utensils found among the tribes that didn't have copper as a resource. So, and that's another example of materials that were exchanged. Basketry played a role in that. So identity, trade, supporting the families, providing means of income, but also in the past, as well as the present, it's a way of cultural expression. A number of presentations I've done in the past provided examples of how the culture is expressed. In some ways, with the utilitarian baskets, it's expressed by the type of basket that's made. When you think about the pack basket, so that's related to hunting. We have fish baskets and eel baskets. We have medicine baskets. So those are very specific to the other cultural practices that are that exist. And so they reflected other activities because those baskets were designed for a specific use. And I guess more contemporary as we think about the expression of ideas, expression of thoughts. And some of the, a lot of the baskets that are made reflect actual objects in nature. We have a thistle basket, a strawberry basket, and the more modern ones are, let's see, a Christmas tree basket, an Easter basket, which is, you know, many of our tribal members are participating in Christianity. So they reflect that. There's a rosary basket. So all of these things are still an expression of people's thoughts and their beliefs.
I'm curious too, and I'd like to hear you chat about the basket making process in general, mm-hmm. almost walking us through from tree to basket, sort of what basket makers are looking for when they walk into a black ash swamp, and how do they get to that final aspect of like expression and creativity?
That's an interesting question and topic. And I'm fortunate to have had the experience of working with some of the elder basket makers. My teachers they've passed on, but I was able to learn from them what the very beginning of that process is. And I think it's important to understand that entire process is important to our community and our community members, and as part of it's traditional environmental knowledge, TEK. I think that's the term that they're using. And I'll talk a little bit about what I call legacy trees, which I think is so important. And I didn't realize how important that was until I had visited a stand a number of years ago and found the marks. I call it marks of our elders. I call them legacy trees. You know, it was just so exciting to find those trees, because those were the footsteps before us, before we arrived there. And there were marks of the elders who were there years ago. And that tells a story about traditional knowledge and how that's used. So the basket making process begins with finding, locating the tree that would be used. The approach that was utilized, which I learned from my teachers, was to go and look for a tree. The first thing you looked for was a healthy tree. And it had to be a certain distance away from, they said, evergreen. So that's just the term they used. It could be a cedar tree, it could be a hemlock tree, it could be a pine tree. And the rationale was you did not harvest a tree that grew next to an evergreen, because it affected the quality of the splint. So they would look for a tree that was straight and no branching. And usually looking for something on the order of a 6-inch diameter, breast height, DBH class tree, and a little bit bigger. So they wouldn't go underneath that. Underneath that diameter. But before they harvested the tree, they would check the tree. They would use an axe and they would chop into the lower part of the tree and take out a couple wedges, and they would be able to inspect the growth rings. The first time that we introduced that to a state forester, the guy was saying, "Oh, what are you doing?" You know. But these legacy trees, with, you know, which I found was the evidence that one of our elders was out there checking trees, and so that if the tree was not ready at that time, he would leave the tree, allow it to grow. So it wasn't cut down and put on a pile and hauled away with others. It was left there. So that knowledge was pretty important. So there's an understanding of the relationship between the basket maker and the trees, and that information was always taught to, if you want to call that an apprentice or somebody that he's teaching about harvesting logs. And I think that's a pretty important concept, because, you know, it illustrates the relationship between people and trees. It teaches the concept of not wasting, and the concept of accepting when that tree is ready course, the tree wasn't ready, and they would move on to the next one. So once that was cut, typically they're hand hauled. I mean, if somebody had the, I guess if they had the luxury of having equipment, then they would haul it out. But it was mostly hand hauled, and usually in the winter, it would be hauled out and dragged on the snow. And then from that point on, they were peeled and then they were pounded. The pounding process typically would use an axe that was, I guess, was conditioned or had been modified so that there was no sharp edges on its on the hammer side of the axe. And that was used to pound the splints out.
The key aspect of black ash basketry is utilizing the annual growth rings from the tree to create splints or thin strips of wood to weave into a basket. As Les mentioned, basket makers will inspect the growth rings to ensure that they are the proper width for making a basket. Rings that are too narrow will break when woven together, and rings that are too wide will be too rigid to actually weave together. If the tree satisfies the ring width requirements, it can then be used for basketry. Pounding the log is the process by which each splint can actually be removed from the tree. Black ash is what we call a ring porous species, meaning that early in the year, the cells that grow in the wood are fairly large and not very tightly packed together. These are what we call early wood cells. As the growing season progresses, the cells that make up the growth ring become smaller and more densely packed, forming what we call late wood. When the log is pounded, what is actually happening here is the basket maker is shattering those early wood cells, which allows them to peel apart each individual width of late wood. That late wood can then be cut and shaved down into the desired length and size, and then woven into a basket.
What would happen after the splints were removed? They could work with them, or they would put them into bundles and save them, you know, for a later time. They would put them in a cool, dry place, hang them for drying, and then once they were needed, they would take them and then they would rehydrate them by soaking them in water. Now that process is with a fresh log, but sometimes they would store the logs in a cool, dry place and they would dry out, but then in order to pound them, they would have to soak them in water, and most often they were placed into a river for maybe about a week to rehydrate them.
Wow, yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't realized that you could store splints. I just assumed that it was kind of like a process that you kind of go through step by step. So now in the current atmosphere in regards to ash in general, we have emerald ash borer, which is wreaking havoc across all of North America, really. And black ash is like one of the most vulnerable species to emerald ash borer. Can you talk a bit about sort of the impacts that emerald ash borer may have on black ash, some of the work that you guys are doing along with other, you know, agencies to sort of preserve black ash, and how this might shape sort of the future of black ash basketry, you know, in regards to that generational knowledge exchange, et cetera, if you're comfortable talking about that as well.
Yeah, that's another good question. I think there's a number of ways to look at that. There are some positive effects, and there are some negative effects. The negative effects obviously would be the loss of the ash trees that are used for basketry, and the continuation of that as a cultural practice. And in terms of, I guess, a diversity or forestry issue, you're going to have some gaps that are developing in a forest, and the potential for invasive species to take their place. Definitely some issues with concerns with regard to hydrology and how the hydrology would be affected. And so you've got all of these environmental forestry impacts that would be result as a loss of ash in general, but black ash as well. It's definitely going to have its impact on the ecology. On the positive side, I guess if we can make some lemonade out of the lemons, is the entire issue has actually provided an opportunity to learn more about ash to the various studies that have taken place. So the when you think about what I said earlier about maybe there being two or three articles about ash, black ash specifically, now there's probably 30,000. There is a wealth of information that has been developed. So that on the plus side, I think, is important. Another positive side is the study or awareness that has been developed about the importance, the cultural awareness. For the most part, a lot of nobody really cared about the ash, black ash, except the tribes that were utilizing it for basketry. So I think it's raised a lot of awareness across the board, whether it's a native community or a non-native community. So I think that's been helpful.
Would you say that this unfortunate circumstance has sort of allowed for more cooperation and collaboration with like government agencies and natural resource agencies outside of the tribal networks?
Oh yeah, that's definitely been a plus. On the plus side is increased interaction between tribes and outside agencies and academia. We've had SUNY ESF as a partner from the very beginning. Definitely U.S. Forest Service, USDA, have partnered with us. Our own New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has been a partner with us. Anything that we've learned and developed, we could not have done without those partnerships. So I think it's definitely provided a good opportunity and platform for exchange of information.
That covers most of my questions that I kind of wanted to talk about today with you, Les. I am curious though, and you know, this question may be a bit heavy, but I'm just interested to hear what your ideas are in terms of the long-term outlook for black ash and basketry. In other words, do you have hope that in the future people will still be able to be making baskets out of black ash?
Oh, yeah. I can jump back to my other thought, and then I'll come back to this. The other one is that the discovery of other materials that we have used in basketry, and that includes maple and maple and hickory, and we've some idea of maybe a cedar, but I think it's more maple and hickory have been used. So that's a plus. So it's taken us back to our own history and look back. We did not always just make baskets from black ash, but we used other woods. So that might help us fill a gap. So now back to your other question. So the outlook, I think what I've had in mind, and especially in an area that's adjacent to this, to our reservation, I think we really need to think about harvesting and stockpiling, but also continue seed collection and storage. So those are important, but also going back to the other, we call them alternative, but the historical usages, start revitalizing and adapting by using those other materials that we used in the past. In some of the discussions I've had, I've kind of illustrated the idea by the fact that 10,000 years ago, 10 to 15,000 years ago, there was a mild sheet of ice sitting on top of where I sit now. So, you know, what happened during that time period? Well, there was nobody here, for one thing. There were no plants here. And so there were some obvious plant and human migrations. And as those migrations took place for humans, the humans adapted. The native people adapted to new environments. We adapted to new materials. So I'm thinking as our ancestors migrated, they utilized different materials. They adapted. So it wasn't always black ash. It was some other plant, some other material. And so I that's kind of the way I look at the future, is just continuing to be resilient and adapting to other materials. But at the same time, you know, just holding on to and utilizing the knowledge that's being developed now to someday have hope for, you know, reestablishing the trees that are important.
I think that's a really good outlook. And I think an outlook of persistence and resilience kind of applies to not just black ash, but really all aspects of life. Mm-hmm. I really like the way you put that, Les. That it gives me hope. So thank you so much for your time. This is really great. I hope it'll also help people interested get a better perspective of black ash and black ash basketry in general.
Take care.
Yeah, you too, Les. Thanks again. The loss of black ash is just one daunting outcome that may result from the emerald ash borer invasion. People like Les, who have dedicated their lives to understanding black ash and working toward its preservation, provide hope that black ash basketry traditions will not be lost and that black ash ecosystems may be preserved. Thank you for listening to this interview. And if you'd like to learn more about black ash or emerald ash borer, take a look at the other pages on the Emerald Ash Borer Information Network website. Special thanks to Michigan State University, as well as the U.S. Forest Service, for helping to fund this podcast. Narrations and music for this podcast were written and produced by me, River Matthews.